Now, the lead casket takes us back to the Bond plot. So let me back up. And now I'm going back to Act 1, Scene 1. This, in fact, governs the entire play. What the entire play is about is giving and hazarding all you have. And it starts with Bassanio wanting to get to Belmont in order to woo. I'm in Act 1, Scene 1, line 140. Antonio says, "You wanted to talk to me, what's it all about? I heard you want to go wooing." And Bassanio says, "In my school days when I had lost one shaft," it's archery, okay? You're out shooting. He loses an arrow. "I shot his fellow of the selfsame flight, the selfsame way, with more advised watch, to find the other forth. And by adventuring both, I oft found both." Okay. I've lost an arrow. What do? "I take another arrow, having just lost one, and I fire it in the same direction. What am I chancing? I'm chancing losing two arrows. So I'm taking a chance. What I'm doing is hazarding more of what I have, and my stock of arrows is severely depleted. But in doing it, he then watches where the second one goes, follows it, and finds both." That little archery metaphor connects with the inscription on the lead casket. And what he's basically saying here is, okay, "I urge this childhood proof because what follows is pure innocence. I owe you much," he says to Antonio. "And like a willful youth, that which I owe is lost. You've already given me money. And it's gone. I spent it, okay? But if you please to shoot another arrow that self way, which you did shoot the first, I do not doubt, as I will watch the aim, or to find both, or bring your latter hazard back again." There's the word. He doesn't want us to miss it. There's the word, okay? "Or bring your latter hazard back again, and thankfully rest debtor for the first. Stake me one more time. I'll repay you." Which means, please notice, if one of the reasons he's going is try to get some money so he can repay his friend, then it would make sense for him to choose the gold or the silver. Okay? Self-interest would say choose the gold or the silver. Antonio simply says, "Of course I'll do it. Of course I'll do it." But the very last speech in Scene 1, "Thou knowest that all my fortunes are at sea. Neither have I money nor commodity to raise a present sum. Therefore, go forth. Try what my credit can in Venice do." Well, let's see. Maybe I can raise some money. "And if I can, I will do what? I'll give it to you." Please notice, this again is not logical. Bassanio's already lost a good bit of Antonio's money. He now comes with another scheme. Antonio says, "I don't have money right now. It's all invested. It's all out in business ventures." Logic says what? "Can't help you. Sorry, you'll have to ask somebody else." Friendship says what? Go the extra distance. Go borrow. Okay. I'll go in debt for you. I will become indebted for you, because I know how important this is for you. And of course, this then makes sense if you're thinking of it in terms of the inscription on the lead casket. When Shylock suggests, by way of a joke or a game, that what the bond should be is, "I'll lend you the 3,000 ducats, but if you don't pay me on that day, I get a pound of your flesh. Cut nearest the heart." What we're getting at that moment is indeed Antonio is offering up his flesh for his friend. He is offering up his life for his friend. He's doing it to someone that everyone knows hates him for his friend. Bassanio says, you can't do this. You must not do this. You're not entering into... Bassanio's a good man. You will not do that for me. No, I draw the line here. And Antonio says, no, my ships will be back. It's all right. And he goes ahead and does it. Clearly, out of love, it is a profound profound friendship. Profound friendship. Got to say a word here. Turn to Acts 3, scene 4. It's very early on. Line 5. Lorenzo is speaking to Portia. Bassanio's won, but the instant he wins, please notice, and again, this is the construction of the plot. He wins, and what we get is at that moment news comes. Like that. Boom. No chance for a happy ending right away. We're in Act 3. We're in the middle of the action. So that, yes, indeed, he wins the gorgeous lady. They are married, and bad news. Bad news. We can't have the happy ending. Why not? Because the world is there ready to kill that happy ending. The ships are lost. We don't know what's happened to them. The bond is due. And Shylock is demanding his pound of flesh. Portia, in her goodness, but also in her wealth, says, well, you know, offer him 2-3 times as much. Of course, go to your friend. Okay? Lorenzo, at the opening of scene 4 of Act 3, says, Madam, although I speak it in your presence, you have a noble and true conceit of godlike amity, which appears most strongly in bearing thus the absence of your lord. Hey, you're just married, and you're taking this pretty well. Most women wouldn't deal with it like this, okay? But then he explains, but if you knew to whom you show this honor, how true a gentleman you send relief, how dear a lover of my lord your husband, I know you would be prouder of the work than customary bounty can enforce you. This is a good man. A lover was used interchangeably with friend, okay? And the notion was that friendship, Neoplatonism was coming back at that point, and the notion was that kind of friendship was a very high love in Platonic terms, precisely because non-physical. Man and wife, fleshly, the love of friends, according to the Platonic ladder of love in the Symposium, even higher because it's a non-physical love. It's a love between two beings, a higher love of friendship. That's what's basically being said here. We have a high love here. This is a good man. This is a good man. Well, he's proven it in the sacrifice he's willing to make. And indeed, he goes into court willing to lay down his life for his friend and says it quite directly, makes his farewell at the moment when it looks like he's going to die. Act 4, scene 1, line 263. Portia, disguised, turns to him, but merchant, have you anything to say? He says, but little, I am armed and well prepared. Give me your hand, Bassanio. Fare you well. Grieve not that I am fallen to this for you, for herein fortune shows herself more kind than is her custom. It is still her use to let the wretched man outlive his wealth, to view with hollow eye and wrinkled brow an age of poverty, from which lingering penance of such misery doth she cut me off. What does he know? He's been engaged in money, financial transactions. It comes down to what? Nothing. You lose it all. If you're building your life on money, you're going to end up poor and miserable. Even if you die with all your money, because in case you don't know, you can't take it with you. You know? Shove it in the coffin. It does you no good. Commend me to your honorable wife. Tell her the process of Antonio's end. Say how I loved you. Speak me fair in death. And when the tale is told, bid her be judge whether Bassanio had not once a love, a friend who loved him very much. Okay? Give to each man what he deserves. Antonio dies for Bassanio, and how will he be remembered? Justly remembered. As a friend willing to go to death for his friend. Not a bad way to be remembered, okay? He makes that point. Repent but you that you shall lose your friend, and he repents not that he pays your debt. For if the Jew do cut but deep enough, I'll pay it instantly with all my heart. And again, the idea of love and the physical reality of my heart, the actual beating organ, become one. What do we have going on throughout the play? That connection between a physical reality and a high ideal. They become one. They become one everywhere in this play. If you do cut deep enough, I'll pay for it instantly with all my heart. Because I love you so much. And because Shylock's going to carry away that organ, which makes everything tick, okay? It's gone. Now, what do we have? We have a friend willing to give and hazard all he hath for his friend. But we've got one more. And this is the one usually overlooked. Especially these days. When Jessica is fleeing from her father's house, this is on page, I'm in Act 2, Scene 6. The maskers are come, they're going to carry her away, okay? Jessica appears at the window in boy's clothing. She tosses down to him, I'm at line 35, she tosses down to him a casket. Here, catch this casket. We find out later what it's filled with. Ducats, gold. We now have a casket with the gold on the inside. Okay? And she's carrying it off from her father's house. She's ripping his heart out doing so. When he shouts, my ducats and my daughter, he does mean both. We do not get a stereotyped villain in Shylock. He does love his daughter. He loves his ducats as much. That's the tension in him. And that is his failing. But he does love his daughter. He's heartbroken. That my ducats and my daughter and my ducats. Well, he's lost his daughter. The ducats go with her. Here, catch this casket. It is worth the pains. I am glad 'tis night. You do not look on me, for I am much ashamed of my exchange. What exchange? She's wearing pants. She is giving up her female identity and disguised herself as a boy to run off with the man she loves. We can grasp it because if she's seen, she will be locked up in her father's house and never get out again. But she knows quite well, okay? Cupid himself would blush to see me thus transformed to a boy. This is an outrageous action for a young woman to take, to dress in men's clothing. But it's worth it for Jessica because it's the only way she can escape her father's house. It's the only way she can be with the man she loves. We have another woman in the play who disguises herself as a man. Actually, two, because Nerissa goes with her. It's Portia, but it's Portia's plan. When she leaves Belmont, the beautiful mountain, the happy habitat, the fairy tale kingdom, and descends into the courtroom in Venice, she has to take on the indignity of men's apparel. She is not only leaving that perfect, beautiful kingdom, but in going to Venice, she is doing something that is positively shameful to put on men's clothing. And she is not doing it to escape Belmont. She could stay there quite happily. She's a married lady. She just got the man she loved. She's not doing it to run off with her love. Bassanio's hers. Nothing's going to happen to him. Antonio gets slaughtered by Shylock. Big deal. Her husband comes home. It's too bad. She is doing it for her husband's friend. She's doing it for a man she's never met. She's doing it out of faith that this man is as good as she's been told he is, in hope that she can win his release and out of love for her husband, which then must extend to his friends. And we have love radiating outward. The moment Bassanio wins, it's a beautiful moment when she submits and turns everything over to him. Absolutely beautiful moment. And she says quite openly at that moment, okay? Happiest of all is that her gentle spirit commits itself to yours to be directed as from her Lord, her governor, her king. Myself and what is mine to you and yours is now converted. But now I was the lord of this fair mansion, master of my servants, queen or myself, and even now, but now, this house, these servants, and this same myself are yours, my lord. I give them with this ring. Please notice, this is just that old canard out there, that the woman in subjecting herself to the man loses her personality and just becomes, at that moment she gives the ring, that is the bond, and then she is willing to sacrifice herself for her husband's friend in an attempt to go down to that world of law and business and finance, disguised in boy's clothing to try to help. Talk about giving and hazarding all you have. Imagine she botches it. Imagine her husband suddenly realizes in the middle of the court of Venice with the Duke there, that's my wife dressed up there. In boy's clothing. It could have turned into cheap comedy, like a Ricky Ricardo moment when he realizes Lucy is there. Lucy, what are you doing? That's old sitcom stuff, okay? And it's very funny. It's funny. Shakespeare could have done that. He doesn't, because we are looking at a higher ideal. We're looking at a much higher ideal. We're looking at a higher comic principle, and that principle is sacrifice, giving, hazarding. She goes into the court, and I'll get into this more tomorrow night, but it's very clear what the tension in the court is. It's between Old Testament justice and New Testament mercy. It's as simple as that. And Shylock speaks for his bond. That is justice. And what the woman becomes, appropriately enough, without people realizing it, is the intercessor for mercy. She is pleading for Antonio's life and makes one of the greatest speeches ever, ever penned on the subject. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's one of those things that's so familiar, one doesn't realize the greatness of it. But when she turns to Shylock, okay, and says, then must the Jew be merciful. His response, on what compulsion must I? Tell me that. Merciful? I got my bond. We're in the court of law. Justice prevails. I'm going to get what I deserve. That's my pound of flesh. The response, the quality of mercy is not strained. Look, I don't have to force you to do this. This is not forced. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. Mercy is as natural as rain. Mercy waters that which is dry and dying and infertile. Mercy causes new life to grow where there was none before. But mercy droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place. The source of mercy is heaven. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. I'm telling you to be merciful not just for Antonio's sake. I'm telling you to be merciful for your sake. It's a blessing on you. Okay? Tis mightiest in the mightiest. Notice the shift. We've gone from rain being gentle. It's now mighty. Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is an attribute to God himself, just magnificent. And earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. In that moment of offering mercy, even the king becomes godlike. And in that action, he proves himself most worthy of being king above the crown, the scepter, the throne, any of it. But notice, when mercy seasons justice, God is first and foremost just. Mercy is the seasoning. If you season something, you put a little bit of it in, okay? But it must be there because it's the seasoning that gives the taste. It's a wonderful. But seasons also going back to the image of the rain falling down, bringing new life to the earth. It's glorious. It's glorious. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. Absolutely true. She warns her, you, listen, you want justice? You're not going to get what you think you're going to get. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. I have spoke thus much to mitigate the justice of thy plea, which if thou follow, this strict court of Venice must give sentence against the merchant there. I still remember that from 40 years ago. Miss Cal made me memorize it. It's still up there. Make the kids who are under you memorize. 40 years later, and the brain's slowing down. The number of cells I've killed through inappropriate beverages, and nevertheless, it sticks. Make them learn it when they're young. It'll be there forever. I'm living proof of it. God bless her for making me learn that speech. Point is this. She warns him. She tells him, nope. He'll have his bond. He'll have his bond. It's not a trick. It's not a trick. It is a simple fact. It proves again what the silver casket says. You'll get what you deserve. You want justice? You'll get justice. And it's not just, okay, you get your flesh. You don't get any blood. Because there is no shedding of blood there, okay? There's only the flesh. There's only the flesh. And, surprise, surprise, that's attempted murder. So you're now subject to the state. You can be killed. And your goods are confiscated. And, I mean, it's just... And he stands there. Well, he got justice. That's the law. And under the law, we're all nailed. We're absolutely nailed. And we're ignorant if we don't know we're nailed. And then what happens? He's shown mercy. The Duke spares his life. The goods that go to Antonio, Antonio is willing to give to his daughter, to Jessica, to Shylock's daughter. Okay. And he can make more money as long as at the time that he, when he dies, it goes to his daughter and the family. This is not unjust. This is all mercy. But even mercy can be hard when you have attempted to live by the letter of the law. And that's what goes on in the courtroom. But none of it would have been possible without Portia taking the chance of being there or loving enough to walk into that courtroom. I just have a few minutes left. Let me do this very quickly. Act 5, I'd hope to read some of it. The poetry is gorgeous, some of Shakespeare's most beautiful. There is a pattern in these plays, in the comedies. Usually we begin in the city, we go off to a country scene, and then we come back to the city. We've learned something out in nature, we come back to the city. Not here, we end up in Belmont. This play does something so spectacular. As the mercy floods, we get to live in that world that seemed above and beyond us. Everyone gets to go there at the end. And not only is it marriage all around and music all around and moonlight beaming down, not a bad place to be, but you get there and the next thing you discover is somebody hands you a letter that says all your ships have come in. Bingo, you get all your money as well. Now, it's a quick comic turn, but it's not just that. It means what? It means the title character. It's one of the last things that happens in the play. The merchant of Venice, having sacrificed everything, lost everything, laid down his life for his friend, suddenly finds himself in this magical kingdom of moonlight and music and love and marriage and romance and beauty, and he gets it all. Everything he thought he had lost is recovered. And the surprise for Bassanio and Gratiano, the ring plot, very quickly. After the victory in the courtroom, Bassanio says, oh, let me pay you. Let me give you lots of money. She said, the young lawyer says, oh, no, I don't want any of that. I'd like that ring. It's like, oh, no, ask me anything but not that. Oh, no, I have nothing but that ring. Oh, no, okay. And, you want to give it to me, that's fine. Off she goes. And Antonio then makes a little speech. Oh, look what she saved, my life. It's not too much to ask, but my wife gave me this ring. Oh, she'll understand. It's just like, okay, awesome, okay. Oh, when I get home, it's like, she's going to throw crockery at me, I know. Okay. We get back to Belmont, and of course, it's first Nerissa who takes on Gratiano. You gave the ring to a lawyer's clerk? And then Portia's, well, where's your ring? It's like, sorry, honey, I had to. And Antonio steps in to defend him. Well, if you understood. And then what do we find out? The ring suddenly appears. Where? With Portia again. How is this possible? Because the lawyer who saved everyone down there in the courtroom, disguised in an unrecognizable manner, is really the wife. The two are one. The figures from the two different worlds end up being the same. So that when he gave this ring, he was giving it to his wife. She received what was rightfully hers. He was not giving it away, although when he did it, he thought he was what? Giving and hazarding all he hath for his friend who had given and hazarded all he had for Bassanio, except now we got trouble, don't we? Nope. Not in this Christian world with a vision of the harmony of marriage, faith, hope, charity, and love expanding outward, where there is oneness. There is oneness. And you give and do for someone else, and it turns out it was someone you didn't even think it was. Why? Because the two are one. It's all one. It is in a small way, in a comic way, in a beautiful way, a vision of the mystical body. The mystical body operating in the world. Where I thought you were the lawyer. No, you're my wife. Wait, the two are the same? You're the one who gave that speech, who saved my friend, who hazarded for me, that I now hazarded for him, that you hazarded for both of us, and let the music play and the moonlight beam down. It's gorgeous. But it's more than just a regular marriage at the end of the play. What is it? My friends, it's the wedding feast at Cana. Shakespearean comedy doesn't just end with a marriage as Roman comedy did. I'll explain that this summer. Shakespearean comedy ends with a vision of the wedding feast, where the wedding, that marriage ceremony, is a sacrament. And there isn't just the joy of the wedding. There is a spiritual burst of joy and energy, and that which seemed ordinary, plain, water becomes wine because a miraculous transformation has taken place. And that which seemed to be just a wedding feast with guests around turned out to have the Son of God at it and the Mother of God, who's quite willing to redirect the course of history for the good of all of those who are there. Okay? They've run out of wine, she tells her son. Woman, my time has not yet come. Tell the stewards to fill, okay? And suddenly joy abounds. Why? Because the good woman has stepped in to see that out of her love, out of her concern, out of her faith, out of her hope, out of charity, that the joy will continue. And it's more than earthly joy. It can't just be earthly joy, or it would just end there. And the uplift and the beauty of The Merchant of Venice and all of those Shakespearean comedies is that he is looking upward and beyond. Yes, the individual and society are reconciled in marriage, but heaven and earth are reconciled too. because the Son of God himself descended, took on human flesh, and gave to all of us. And that is memorialized everywhere in Shakespearean comedy. In the final comedies, the great romances, it gets spelled out in big, bold letters. That's Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, a great comedy. The world no longer allows that play to exist. The reason I can't teach this play again, the reason why it's now shunted out of classrooms, is because it's no longer The Merchant of Venice, a comedy by William Shakespeare. It's now The Tragedy of Shylock, a play rewritten by the modern world. And I'll talk about that tomorrow night. Questions, yes.
Speaking of what you just said about the odd treatment of Jessica in the Olivia production that we saw last night, is this part of the rewriting?
It's total rewriting. It's total rewriting and a complete violation of the ending of the play. Complete violation. I'll go into this in detail tomorrow night, but notice one hugely important detail. Act 5 is set at night in moonlight. Sun comes up real early. There's a sun beaming down. We're back in day. We're not allowed the magic beauty of the night. We get a touch of it, and then, bam, the sun is up, and we're back. We're back in the cold light of the sun, the hot light of the sun. And Venice intrudes itself, and not in a happy ending that Antonio's ships have come in. Something much more profound has happened. It's a rewriting of the, a total rewriting of the ending, and a complete twisting of Jessica's character. But hey, we can't do the play as Shakespeare wrote it. He got it wrong. We're gonna get it right. In the same way we're rewriting everything else today. If modern man looks at nature, if modern man looks at society, if modern man looks at religion and says God designed it wrong, we'll redo it right, then modern man also looks at those great artists who have given expression to God's creation and says they got it wrong, we'll rewrite them and get it right. And that's what happens to this play. That's what happens to this play, yeah. Yeah. I'll fulminate at length about that tomorrow night. Yeah. No, total rewriting. Total rewriting. Yeah. There are other ugly rewritings of it as well that I'll mention tomorrow night as well. That's not the only thing they do with it. They've got other modern tricks they're playing now. But they can't do it as written. They can't do it as written. Modern world can't stomach it. Yeah. It's... Yes. That's all right. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's vanished. Let me just say this quickly. Shakespearean clown, he's Shylock's servant. We get three fathers in the play. Portia's father, who's gone, Shylock, who's there and loves but doesn't do it in the proper way, and old Gobbo, Lancelot's father, comes in, who's blind. And there's this, it can be funny if you've got great comics doing it. If you don't have great comics, it's a dreadful scene where the son teases his father and the father's asking after his son and the son pretends to be somebody else and then finally says, but I'm really your son. And the line is in there, it's a wise father that knows his own child. Comic treatment of what we're getting in the serious plot. And then there's a riotous scene where he kneels down and the old man touches him to give him his blessing, but he turns around backwards. So he's feeling the back of his head and all this hair and says, you know, boy, you've got quite a beard. You know, I didn't realize you had this much hair on you. Well, again, it's a comic vision of Esau and Jacob. So that even there we get the playing of the father knowing the child. But Old Testament ramifications through that with a very different kind of knowledge of father and child in the main plot. Plus, it gives Shakespeare a chance for some of those bad puns that he just loved. Just loved. They're tough to do now because the meanings are lost. But you get a great comic in the role. I've seen some great comedians do it. It's still funny, even though you're not quite sure what they're saying.
This concludes CD 2. Please insert the next CD.